So it's always good to start with what we're doing and why we're doing it. Why do we practice breathing like we did just now together? There's so many things that we could be doing, and yet here we are on a Sunday with each other, cultivating this energy, following our breath. Must be something to it because we're doing it. And so we come together, we breathe, we share about the Dharma, how it affects us. So we could say that we come together to breathe, to find peace of mind, right? Because we get to notice that when we breathe, it begins to calm us down. We actually do get peace of mind. And then when we're in a difficult situation, because we've been doing this, sometimes we remember to breathe again, and then we get that peace of mind again. Sometimes the situation is so difficult, so many things coming up, we forget to breathe. And that's okay too. Because we keep practicing, you know, we keep coming back on a Sunday or another group, or and we keep breathing together because we see something, we get something from it. We're all intelligent people here. And so there is something we're experiencing from this breathing and following the breath. And then we breathe and we come together and we listen to Dharma, sometimes because we believe that if we do this, we're going to really transform our karma here and now, right? And that it will serve us in the next lifetime. If we believe, you know, in this as a practice that that doesn't end in this form, didn't begin in this form, and then therefore will continue in some other form. And we feel that if we practice with kindness, with understanding, with good intentions, with generosity, with deep listening, with loving speech, not killing, not stealing, not committing sexual misconduct, not lying, not taking intoxicants that make us vulnerable to do those four things mentioned, that it'll affect the next lifetime. Yeah. And so we practice, we breathe together, we bring tranquility to mind and body, and we remember the trainings, the precepts, and we believe that it'll affect this karma, this action that we do in this lifetime is going to affect the next lifetime. And then the third way that we can think about why we come together and breathe and listen to Dharma with each other is liberation. Yeah, that full, complete, I'm done, not coming back, signing off, say, what is it? Sayonara? I can't remember that now. Oh my gosh. Oh. Anyway, you know what it means. I'm out of here. Peace out. That we practice for our complete liberation, for this deep depth of understanding that cannot be actually shared with each other in words, because it's beyond words, right? And all of it often starts from, I'm going to practice with this renunciation, because we're renouncing something in order to come together, right? You put down something today to come together here. You could have done something else. So you put it aside, right? You said, I will put this aside and I'm going to come. I'm going to link into the Zoom and I'm going to be in community. I'm going to breathe together. I'm going to listen to Dharma and I'm going to share my Dharma. Yeah. So we're, you see, the path is a path, whether we want to believe it or not, the path is a path of renunciation. Yeah. We're choosing, we're making choice, we're in full choice. Yeah. I made a choice. I look forward to being in community and breathing together and deepening my practice. I've made a choice that that is the focus of my life. That's going to be the foundation of my life, my breath, and getting to know this breath, the curiosity of what's in this body, what's to be transformed, right? So it's a path of renunciation. And in communities of color, sometimes we have a hard time with this idea of renunciation, because as communities of color, there's been a lot of suffering around race, racism. So even if we're not even talking about all the other identities that has brought, it's not just individual, but the collective suffering, just talking about one right now, race. And so in communities of color, oftentimes we tend to think, what? I already have lived a hardship. My ancestors have gone through like hell. You know, you're gonna tell me I've got to like put down these things that might bring me a little bit of joy? Well, and yet, if we understand what we're renouncing, the smaller joy for this big, non-ending joy, it kind of shifts things, right? So, if we look at the history of Buddhism and what we know and understand from the teachings, right, interpreted by male-bodied people, and so, we always have to remember this. The Buddha, as we understand, left the lay life as a person with pretty much a lot of privilege, right? Left a partner and a child to wander. Not just to wander physically, but to wonder, right? To let the mind wonder what else was there. What else was there? And felt he wanted all the spaciousness to do that. They want to be restricted to the home life where there's responsibilities to do this, you got to do that, all that. Wanted to wander around and wonder about what else is there. So that was his form, right? One of his forms of renouncing the life as he knew it, the things that came with that, putting down that, relinquishing, turning away from that, turning away, and all the things that that had convinced him that that was the thing to do. So it takes a lot of deep. It doesn't. It doesn't take a lot of the deep knowledge. It does take a lot of deep intelligence to be able to put down something that in the moment gives us pleasure and to know that there's something greater. It's a greater pleasure. So knowledge doesn't give us that. If that was true, everybody with a whole lot of knowledge would be renouncing life left and right, and all kinds of different things would be going on. So we know that that's not true. We know that it's something else. It's something. There's a knowing, a different kind of knowing, this heart knowing, this reconnected knowing with something inherent in us that knows there's something else. There's a noticing that has happened, and then it has turned us to know and reconnect to something intuitive, whatever it is, what is it that each one of us was touched by to bring us into this path that we're all on together. So it's often good to reflect on that. Where did this, for us, for each of us, where did this start for us, this particular path? Often it doesn't continue the way it started. Often it's going to change. There's many ways. And so with the way we touched it and were awakened to this Dharma is different in the next day and in the next year and the next, like that. in the next 10, 20, 30 years, it's going to shift, because the more we practice and the more we renounce, actually, because the more we renounce what's there available and so easy for us to grasp onto, the more that's going to become available, hidden by the things that we renounce, those small pleasures, as we put them down and turn away from them. You know, it's like you turn away, you know, when you turn away from something, you are turning towards something. So we turn towards something else as we turn away, as we relinquish. There is something else that we're picking up. Yeah, we're reconnecting to something. We're turning toward. And so we can't get caught up in this, like, oh, there's not something else that I have to put down. Is there, like, serious though? Like, what all the things I didn't have? Are you kidding me? I have these things now. You're telling me that I got to put that away too? So we don't get caught up in that. We look at what else there is when we put down that we're turning toward and picking up. So the understanding that the turning away is turning away from something that also binds us to a certain set of, pleasures, right? Pleasures in a way. Maybe there's some desire for this kind of life, and so, you know, we hold on to that, and so we're bound to that. But then when we notice and we put it down, because we realize, oh, there's something else, now we're not bound anymore. So this attachment, this thing that can, like, blind us, it gets also opened up. And so that's the opening up, right? So even the attachment, when we start to become aware of it and notice it, we put it down. But that's hard. That's hard to do. That's really hard to do, right? Because that's how we've been living. And the whole society has been telling us that this is what we're supposed to do. Let us just do it. And it's especially hard when you live in a society when the majority of the people are doing the same thing over and over again. And it's why we come together in groups like this, because we're on this path. We're putting down, we're turning to something else. We're questioning what we desire. What does it bring? We're questioning what we hate. Why do we hate it? Is there something else? We're questioning the illusory nature of what we live in, this kind of mundane world that has been set up for us to walk in, kind of sleepwalking, kind of blind in. And so this putting down is waking up, right? Even though it can sound like, oh, I'm giving up so much, man, you know, I'm giving up my afternoon, you know, but this understanding that we're forsaking a limited ease. And I have this quote from the Dhammapada here. Let's see if I can do this. Yeah, there we are. Yeah, that, let's see, yeah, that we give away or we relinquish to reject or to disown, put down, but that we're understanding that we're liberating ourselves from that thing, that itself is a part of our liberation, yeah? So the liberation is not something. It doesn't have to be this, oh my God, it's at the end of the road. That's the liberation. No, every time we put down and turn away and renounce, it's a part of our liberation. We've just liberated ourselves from something that harms us because we get attached to it, right? So just there, right then, we can demythify this idea of renunciation as something that's so hard and difficult, as we transform it into seeing that as we liberate ourselves, we're liberating ourselves from that. This is part of our liberatory path, right? So that's easy to, that, you know, that's clear, that's easy to understand, right? Now, here's that quote from the Dhammapada. If by forsaking a limited ease, one would see an abundance of ease, the enlightened person would forsake the limited ease for the sake of the abundant. And I should probably read that other slide because I forget this is, we only shared an audio. So the renunciation on this slide saying, give away or relinquish, reject, disown, detach, put down, turn away. To put something down, to be liberated from that which harms. And in that process, we see that there is harm, right? We see that that thing may be causing harm. And the harm that it's causing may not be outright a direct harm. It's the attachment to it and then the expectation of it to be continued, not understanding the impermanence of it. And then we suffer and then we get harmed and then we look for more and we then try to find something that's going to stay. And even while the teaching is that it is impermanent. So this liberation from that view, that putting down, that's the liberation already. So you see that this renunciation, it's not just, I'm going to stop doing this. It's also this mind of seeing, as I hold on to this thing, it could cause me harm because it's going to make me continue to grasp and attach and seek in a certain way, continuously tethered to that way of thinking and doing. And so here comes where we want to talk about decolonization. So here's a definition. Some of you might remember, this is from Tuck and Yang. And there are different ways that we can define decolonization. So we're using this one here. These are two distinct but overlapping tasks. The first concerned with how the invisibilized dynamics of settler colonialism mark the organization, governance, curriculum, and assessment of how we learn, this compulsory way that we must learn, we're taught to learn, right? The other is concerned with how settler perspectives and worldviews get to count as knowledge and research, and how these perspectives repackage as data and findings, fact, right, fact, are activated in order to rationalize and maintain unfair social structures, right? So this understanding, the way as people of color, we have come to be colonized in our thinking and our way of being, and to view ourselves as the other, the undeserving other relative to whiteness. Yeah. All based on data and knowledge created by settler colonial ideas and behaviors, and how we as a people, as Black people, brown people, have decided that that's the truth. And so this putting aside, this is part of our liberation, the decolonizing, right? And you can, you know, you can even say, yeah, renunciation is a way of decolonizing in the biblical sense of the word, in the dharmic sense of the word. But I'm not going to push us there yet. I'm just going to stay right now with connecting how this process of turning away from the colonized mentality is a turning toward the beauty and the inherent wonder of who we are that we have never really been allowed to explore because we're so tethered to what settler colonization has said we are as a people. Yeah. And that part of our liberation, just in this one, let's just take up this one suffering of racism, internalized racism that all of us as people of color hold. Just take up this one suffering and the understanding that we will have to, in our path of liberation, turn away and relinquish that which we have been reared and honestly breeded to believe is true. That we are nothing relative to whiteness, that we are always relative to whiteness. Yeah. I want to talk about how deep it is, this effect of settler colonialism in our bodies and mind as people, and how intergenerational it is, how it's so deep inside. So I'm going to talk about three things. I'm going to talk about experiments, some studies that were done in Japan. I think it was in the 70s. So everything I'm going to mention, the studies I'm going to mention are from this book called The Heart's Code, written by, I have it in this room. It's on another slide, you can see. So this study in Japan, one of the islands off Japan, where they had a colony of monkeys. And one monkey named Aima learned how to clean potatoes and taught other sibling monkeys. But for some reason, the monkeys on the other islands learned how to clean the potatoes the same way. Different island, different set of monkeys, and yet in these studies showed that somehow it got uptake. There was an uptake from the other monkeys. So the skill set seemed to jump to another island nearby, even to Japan, the main island of Japan. Right? And no way of understanding or explaining that. Yeah. So what I'm going to get at here is how generationally, in a society that has said to us who we are as folks of color, intergenerationally, right? Many, many generations, many, many years, there's a way that we are impacted beyond genetics, even from the environment, from the uptake of the social messaging of how we do things. You know, when we think about how our parents act and do a certain thing, act and are carry themselves in a certain way. Yeah. And we always think, oh, it's genetic. And it's also from the environment, right? This other one showing the effect, this is experiments with the US Army, where they took cells from the mouth of participants, individuals that were doing these studies with, and they put the cells in a petri dish elsewhere, right, in another room. And sometimes it was 50 miles apart, the cells would be there 50 miles away, and the individual whose cells that were taken, they're here. And they exposed them to different videos of violence. And then they test the chemicals being produced by the cells, right? In another room, they initially started in another room, and then they took it further and further, 50 miles away, to see that the cells were activated. So the cells are, you know, have been taken from the body of the person, but now the person is being exposed to violence. And yet there is some connection, there is a way that it continues on. Right? And the last one I'm going to talk about is how we affect not just each other in the way we think and what we're doing and the way the environment impacts us, but we also do that to machines. So this is over a million trials at Princeton, where they have people try to affect the random generation of numbers from a machine, right? The machine randomly generates numbers. That's what we know random generating machines to do. And how people different people they're using in their studies and experiments are trained to sit next to the machine and send their thoughts of what they want the machine to produce, what numbers they want to come next, and how this impacts the machine. And the machine then stops producing random numbers and produces, and they check in with what the person next to the machine is telling the machine to produce. And then next thing you know, the machine is producing in that pattern that the person is trying to affect. And different things that have been done, changing a pendulum swings, changing the pattern of the pat of the how the pendulum swing, swings, and the rhythm of a computer drum. Okay, so the reason I bring this into this sharing today is that the way that we have been conditioned, and we're all conditioned by the environment, we're all conditioned by the status quo, we're all conditioned by what we've been told is beautiful. Who's beautiful? Well, this is what we were told beauty is, right? This is what, 1909? Sunday magazine, image of a, what's beauty? White women looking a certain way, right? And so this is part of what has been affecting us, you know, so in some way we can say that when we're told, as folks of color, we're told that this is beauty, that's a violence, right? Because what that does is it denies our existence. It's saying, look in the mirror. If you don't look like this, then you're not beautiful. You're not normal. You're not appealing. Your eyes a certain way, it's not like this, nope. Hair a certain way, not like this, nope. Right? And so that has an impact. And it's not just the thinking, it's not just the brain, it's also embodied. So that's what those experiments I just reviewed is trying to tell us, that there's an uptake of what is there. Is in the social norm, and that it's not, and it goes beyond the time and space of someone genetically passing it to you. And that's part of what we, as folks of color, in our collective and individual liberation, we will need to listen so deeply we can find it. Where it hides in ourselves, because it's there in ourselves, in our body. And then we have to turn away from it. We have to put it down. We have to relinquish it. And we have to turn toward who we are, right? The beauty of who we are, all of it. Yeah. And this is our path of liberation. Because this is in us, right? That first reason for practice, the one where we bring calm and peace to our mind, sometimes there's no wisdom there. You didn't hear me say that, but I sure did, and it's recorded. And yet, you know it's true. That sometimes we can be in tranquil meditation, bringing our minds and bodies to ease. And yet, if we don't go deeper to undo all the suffering, to turn all that's in our bodies, if we don't go deeper to undo that, to turn away from that, to relinquish all the things that hold us. Honestly, in bondage, in captivity, if we don't take this practice and allow this practice to help liberate that, then we're not touching fully all that's possible in the Dharma, the deepest Dharma. Because that's what turning away means. That's really putting down the things that in our body. That's why we do these body meditation. What is there? What are we holding on to? Yeah. What does 500 years of settler colonialism in the United States of America and the Americas, really, right? Like what's there in us that needs to be transformed, that needs to be released and put down, relinquished, turned away from? How do we bring ease to those areas of our body that are still holding on to that? Because we our liberation is that, is turning away from that. It's not just the moment here where today someone treats us in a certain way because of what we look like. It is this history that lives in our body. And all of us who do somatic healing and embodied work, we know it. Sometimes we don't name it as such. And yet what it is that we're noticing and sensing in our body is this history that has, over the years, has continued, right? You know, just like how the monkey, like on a different island, picked up a way of doing something. We have picked up ways of being with each other and being with ourselves that we must undo. And we have the skills, we have the tools. We have a path, we have a practice. That's why we breathe, that's why we sit and we look in our bodies. That's why we quieten down the mind. And we didn't do that in this meditation. Sometimes as we start to look into the body, things come up in our mind and they're like, why, ooh, where did that come from? And that's some of the, what's been stuck in there, what's been stuck. And we start to open it up and it's not easy, right? It's bumpy. The path is not, but it's the, right? The path is not bumpy. But it's that relinquishing of something that sometimes bring up suffering. But it's a different kind of suffering because it's a suffering that's actually leading us to our liberation. Even though it may feel hard as we do this, it's a different kind of suffering. So it's a lot, and yet it's such a beautiful path because it's a liberatory path. It's not a path that's leading us to stay bonded to things that are not beautiful or healthy for us. And every step we make that opens us up to see ourselves in the most light way of being light and fluffy and open and spacious, able to transform and not be beat down. If we're in a path that allows that, it's pretty miraculous, right? So we renounced today a couple hours of doing things that the quote normal regular society would do. And so we're all on our path together in different ways. So the invitation is to congratulate ourselves, to recognize that we are on our path. And that every time we remember, whether we walk mindfully, whether we chew mindfully, whether we sit, whatever it is we do, we should do an awareness that this is a path of liberation, that it's deep, that it's powerful, and that it's healing the ancestors and it's healing the descendants. Because this practice transcends time and space. The transformation transcends time and space. Ty used to always talk about this. So I will leave it here, and I'll invite a sound of the bell for us to breathe together, and then I'll invite someone to lead us in the guidelines for Dharma sharing.